are strictly those of its participants and are not necessarily those of WWPR Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
I was only having fun, wasn't hurting anyone, and we all enjoyed the weekend for a change. I stranded in the combat zone, I walked to Texas sky alone, and rode my motorcycle in the rain. And you told me not to try, but I made it home alive. So you said that only proves that I've been saved. You made me right, I made me crazy. No, but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for. Turn out the light.
Good morning, it's time for the Morning Edge. Here on WWPR, heard Monday through Friday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 9 to 10 a.m. I'm Henry Riggs. Here's Augie.
Good morning, Henry. Good morning, Tampa Bay. And, we're talking bubbles if you're reading Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate on economics. I'm not sure that I fully have digested the bubbles, but if I burp, you'll understand why. The issue he's talking about, are we in a bubble? Are we potentially in a bubble? And whether it's real estate or... are we going to have a sudden, fearful calamity? And the whole thing boils down to the issue of essentially unemployment. When unemployment drops by 1% from 7.5 to 6.5, you gain about 15% of revenue increase on the entire situation. When money becomes shorter from that demand, that means the cost of money goes up, therefore interest rates goes up. But they don't go up radically, they go up gradually, and the QE 1, 2, 3, and 4 that Bernanke had put into place come into play. So it really is, no, according to Krugman, just see if I can get a shortened quote here. It's hard to see why the Fed should raise rates until unemployment falls a lot and inflation surges, and there's no hint that the data, that anything like that is likely to occur. At this point, Japan is well above twice its gross domestic product, and budget deficit remains large, and the interest rate on 10-year bonds is 0.6%. Now, they have 200% of gross domestic product debt. So what we have here is about 70-80% going down, and as the elevator says, you're going down. That means you're going to get to the basement, and when you get to the basement, you got to go back up a floor. Somewhere along the way, there'll be resolution, and that's essentially where Krugman is at this point, and I'm not sure fully how I can better explain it, but anyhow. So we're going to move on to some other matters, and I think one of the other ones on economics would be the student loan rate, what's happening there. We can talk about that a little bit. Any thoughts you have at 941-745-1490, and we're going to have there's going to be a caller in one to be a guest, and we have a guest today. And do you want to tell us about that, Henry?
Good morning, Ari.
Morning.
Yes, we have Ellie Corpus, who is a religion news analyst. She also has a business out in Texas called Ellie's Spiritual Treasures, and she wants to talk about Pope Francis. And will he reform the Vatican? Something that you've talked about a lot.
Boy, have I ever. Do I have some thoughts for that. But anyway, will he reform it? It depends on how hard the deal is. And it's interesting that Benedict is back in the Vatican. He didn't stay some other place like he was supposed to. He's moved back in. So my guess is they're watching. And if you recall, Benedict is the guy whose nurse...
Who's watching who?
The new pope.
Who's watching?
Benedict and his henchmen. Let's put it that way. This is white-robed thuggery. And that's why, if you recall... Those who know, the Klan dressed with pointed hats and white robes as a mockery in the late 1800s, or 1900s, well, excuse me, late 1800s, they mocked Rome. They had a real hatred for Rome for various reasons, but nonetheless, they mocked them with the robes.
Klan?
The Ku Klux Klan. They did that. And so what I'm saying is that They weren't far wrong about some of the nature of the.
They did that to pretend they were spiritual ghosts terrorizing.
Well, they did that too. That ultimately became part of the whole thing. What was the great film back in 1920 they made about
Birth of a Nation,
right? But it became a power thing.
Well, wait a minute now.
All right, okay.
What presence would people in the South have seen of Roman Catholic clergy or bureaucracy in the kind of robes that we see with the Pope on TV now? Why wouldn't they would have seen priests in dark black outfits like were more common?
The general mantra that the Klan carried forward was the powers that they resented the most were the Roman Catholic Church, the Jews, a whole raft of enemies that they contrived and put forward in their larger agenda. The governor of Indiana in the early 1900s was the head of the Klan in the North. So they saw themselves in a bigger role, in an international role, and they saw international threats coming out of Rome and other places. So we have a caller?
Yeah, but I still can't buy into this because I've seen pictures of the Klan from the post-Civil War era, and they didn't have the elaborate dress that they have now. There had to be an evolution out of the...
Oh, I'm sure it was.
From the origination of it.
I think that's exactly right.
Okay. We have Jeff on the line.
Good morning, Jeff. Are you Jeff Fish?
I certainly am.
Yeah, Jeff, you have a little story to tell.
He needs to turn down his radio,
but we do need to have the after effects of your radio there.
I don't have a radio on.
Well, we're getting background sound.
The volume of the phone then is echoing into your room.
Maybe the phone is on too loud. I'll turn down the volume 1 second.
That's it. Probably should we have a speaker button.
How's this?
That sounds better.
Okay.
So you've got a book called, and we won't do the interview totally on the book today, but tell a little bit about it. What's the title of the book and what you want to come on the show and talk about?
Well, the title of the book is The Myth of Race. I'm a retired psychology professor, and I've done a lot of work in this field. I got interested in the topic. Basically, what the book does is it tries to sort of explode a lot of myths about race based on scientific knowledge. And I got interested in this because I'm married to an African-American anthropologist who studies Brazilian Indians. And we lived in Brazil for several years. And the way Brazilians think about race is just completely different from the way Americans do. And so I began to research the topic. Over the years have done a lot of work on it. And then this new book brings a lot of that work sort of together in, it's a brief book, a paperback, it's inexpensive, and it's an e-book, and the idea is to just make a lot of this information available. And among some of the things that the book deals with is that Americans have a belief that a person's race is fixed at birth, like caste in India, but the book shows how people can change their race. People believe that the human species has biological races, mainly Caucasoid, Mongoloid, and Negroid, but the book shows how this is an 18th century idea that science has shown to be false for over half a century. People assume that the word race has the same meaning in different cultures, but in fact, the meanings vary all over the place, but because people speak different languages, nobody knows that when they think that they're talking about the same subject, they're talking about different ones. I'll just give a quick example from Brazil, that one study by the people who do the census there asked people what in the northeast of Brazil what color they are, and they got 134 different answers.
Jeff, before you go on too much further into the nature of the book, we do want to have you back on again. So we'll be contacting you as to a particular date. You can recheck with me and or Henry But we'll set up a time to have you do a somewhat in-depth discussion of the myth of race.
Terrific.
Well, I'm confused because you've told me what race isn't, but the book, The Myth of Race, what is race then?
I guess there are two parts to it. One part is what you might call social race, which is there's a word race, and then how do people in a culture use that word? And then the other part, which you might call biological race, which we know doesn't exist, that's a belief that Homo sapiens has subspecies, the way there are, for example, African elephants and Asian elephants, but human beings don't have that. All that really exists is that there's, as you look around the planet, people gradually get different as you move from one place to another, and if you go in different directions, they look different in different ways. So basically, there are those two parts. There's what does human variation actually look like around the planet, and then how do different cultures make sense of that, and one of the concepts they use is race, and then how do they use that concept in different cultures. But that, again, that's pretty separable from the biology.
Henry, do you want to follow on to your question?
So how did people describe themselves? When did the concept of race come to be, and how did people describe groups of people that were outside their primary loyalty? When people from one part of the Middle East warred on another part of the Middle East, how did they view each other?
Oh, well, there are all kinds of ways of looking at people for being different. You can look at them for being different based on religion, based on the language they speak, based on their customs, the foods they eat. What happened was that historically it had to do with European conquest. And as the European colonial powers took over different parts of the world, because these places were very distant, the people looked pretty different, although, of course, if you looked at all the intermediate places, you couldn't find any place where you could draw a line. So that you had, let's say in the case of the English coming to the United States, you had here Northern Europeans, and then you had slaves who were imported from West Africa, and again, in terms of evolution, you're talking about going across up the Sahara Desert, across North Africa, into the land bridge, into Eurasia, and then back east, back west to England. So that's quite a long distance. And then you had the Native Americans that they encountered. And again, those are essentially Asians who came over the Bering Straits about 15,000 years ago. And so you had these three very distant genetically groups of people, and they came color-coded. And so they just sort of invented the topic. This came along about the same time that as phrenology tried to make inferences about people from the, you know, their personality from the bumps on their head. They also tried to make inferences about what they were like from what they looked like. But it was really a result of conquest.
Well, but still, that is a greater geographical distance, and there's going to be a greater visual difference between the individuals. Where did you get from the tribal animosities between groups of people?
Wow.
To actually assigning a different type of person, from tribal to either ethnic or tribal to some other kind of designation of your enemy?
Well, again, when you say when did you get this, it's almost also a question of where did you get this, because this is a European concept. The last chapter of the book compares the evolution of the human species and distribution around the planet over 200,000 years, the spread of humans out of Africa. And we know, by the way, that the original humans began in East Africa about 200,000 years ago, modern humans. Over tens of thousands of years, with the spread of the race concept out of Europe over a couple of hundred years. And if Europe hadn't conquered much of the rest of the world, then the race concept wouldn't have spread.
So you're blaming this on the Europeans. I think you have to look at, I mean, the Dutch West Indies Company and those things which use race or develop the differences to excuse how people were used or employed or whatever you want to say. Those factors, I think, come into play. And caste, I think, is a big part of that. It keeps people in their place and business operates happily thereafter. Race, I think, is an excuse as much as anything else.
That's true. And in addition, what you had was each of these colonial powers had a different legal system. And they encountered different peoples in their colonies. And they had different ecological conditions that were there, and they used the conquered peoples in different ways. And so all of these mixed together to get a different set of categories that were used to essentially make the system work. And then these categories got sort of ossified into law, and then the science of the day put a biological stamp on it, and so you got these differing ideas of race that grew up in different places. And as I said, because they spoke different languages, people didn't really know that they had these very different concepts.
We're speaking with Jeff Fish. He's the author of The Myth of Race, and I assume that's available on Amazon and other.
Amazon and Barnes and Noble. As I say, it's an ebook. It's a paperback. Your local bookstores can order it. I hope people get to read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not to dispute your premise in the aggregate, but see, specifically, I just don't buy that. Maybe semantically, the word race came out of the European culture. But you can look at Asia way before the Europeans dominated Asia. Japan is one of the most racist cultures on the planet. And if you look at China, with its huge population, it's one of the most homogeneous populations. Something like only 10% of that huge population is not of the ethnic main strain of the people.
Well, you don't want to confuse ethnicity with, again, that's the distinction between social race and biological race. That cultural homogeneity doesn't necessarily mean genetic homogeneity. Actually, what we have, in other words, the image of races is that you've got different races in different places, that there's an African race, an Asian race, and a European race, for example. But actually, that isn't what we know from evolution. What happened was that the human species began in Africa about 200,000 years ago, and so folks have been evolving in Africa for all 200,000 years, so that in terms of genetic variability, the great bulk of human genetic variability is in Africa right now. So that if the human species did have biological races, they would all be in Africa.
We do want to come back to you and have...
Sure. We could do this another time, of course.
We want to do this down the short run of the next week or two. And so we want to recontact and make arrangements accordingly. And I think it's a delicious conversation. I would like to keep going with it. And Henry's questions, I'm sure, are still lurking in the back of his mind.
There's all kinds of things lurking in the back of my mind.
We won't talk about those.
Well, I'll be glad to do my best to answer them.
Okay, Jeffrey.
It's The Myth of Race. Check out Amazon.com.
Find
out more about it.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Okay. Well, race. There's a race to get from one point to the next. And I watched Morning Joe this morning, and he had a whole raft, a big cast on, I'm trying to think who they were, Al Hunt and Who's the gal from the
Cokie Roberts?
Cokie Roberts,
Wow, isn't it amazing how the gal from it? I knew who it was.
Well, you knew. Well, she is. She's got that depth of personality and that probity that even Joe. She backed Joe off of talking over her, which Mika never could do on the matter of the Benghazi thing and what that's turning into or turned into. The testimony is one thing. Some later emails, I guess, that look somewhat...
Yeah, just what I see from the ABC report, which was actually just released about a half hour ago. One of the individuals involved in the State Department, looking for the woman's name, anyway, in the back and forth... No, it's someone named Newland. I'm looking for Victoria Newland.
Oh, okay.
And one of the back and forth is the initial talking points were circulated, talked about the fact that the State Department knew that there were at least five other attacks on foreign interests in Benghazi, including the June attack against the British ambassador's convoy. We cannot rule out individuals have previously surveilled the U.S. facilities, also contributing to the efficacy of the attacks. Well, Victoria Newland, the spokesperson for the State Department. By the way, just a quick aside, whoever's writing this ABC report really must have done it on the fly because they called Victoria Newland State Department spokesman instead of spokesperson. And
They put man in there instead of man.
Yeah. Instead of being gender neutral, or spokeswoman. That's what happens when you're on the fly and you just hit the spell check.
At least your fly's down, you're a typical male.
Anyway, she said, you know, the Republicans are just going to use that to beat us up. And so the whole paragraph got deleted. But basically, they knew that there had been a dangerous situation. There had been threats there. And... is there really any doubt in anybody's mind that this was sanitized up in the course of a presidential election to cause the least
I think the
discussion
is possible? Yeah, I watched the testimony from Mr. Hicks especially, and the hearing that he was in, off an emotional view from the ground where officials were desperate for a rescue mission. Mr. Hicks, for instance, described his exchange with a furious leader of the four-member special ops that wanted to fly from Tripoli to Benghazi to help, but was ordered not to. And Mr. Hicks, who's a he's the assistant to Mr. Stevens, who got killed or died, as they like to put it, two different ways. Thompson wanted to see his foreign emergency support team dispatched to the scene and could not understand why superiors didn't agree. But from the detached standpoint of senior officials in D.C., I offered in statements from the Defense Department and the State Department that neither unit could have reached Benghazi before the attacks were over. The team in Tripoli worked much of the night on moving embassy personnel to a secure annex and were not ready to leave for Benghazi until the early morning. The emergency support team would have been deployed from the United States and would have arrived many hours after the last Americans were evacuated. And that's essentially Mr. Hicks and Mr. Thompson both have gotten kind of their backs up. I think they did get pressure as whistleblowers, and it was stated that Mr. Hicks lost his position but didn't lose his paycheck. His paycheck pretty much stayed the same.
Well, it sounds like a logistical and tactical controversy,
yeah,
which they want to pin on Hillary Clinton, which maybe something will come out where she made some decision on this. But the bottom line is, you're in a very situation in flux. They don't know the details of it. It's a crisis situation, and people make decisions based on it. And you can go into other situations where people in the armed services have been in critical situations, and decisions are either made to the betterment or the worse of the people involved. But that happens, and I think it's a valid thing to be looking at. But as far as...
Valid in what way?
To find out if there were mistakes made, if there's a way to handle this better. But it seems to be that it's just a political football now, and one that doesn't...
really have a whole lot of relevance to things going on right now, other than they want to tar Hillary Clinton with something.
Well, Darrell Issa has a history, fast and furious, on the border issue. He brought forward things, and he tended to suppress those who dissented on his panel, leaving them to the end of most hearings to say anything. And without just attacking the Republicans too much, the fact is this is exploitive and not much else. And most of these embassies, I would like to see the before and after of the Benghazi embassy, because they're like forts, and they're usually guarded fairly effectively. And if you've ever been to one, it's like coming.
Well, and this wasn't an embassy; it was a safe house.
Right.
And if you listen to Paula Broadwell and Fox News, they reported that we were holding Al-Qaeda suspects or militia suspects or whatever, warlord suspects, whatever you want to call those people,
That really does open up another can of worms. Yeah. And that goes right to, what was his name, the guy that she was under the desk with?
General Petraeus?
It
doesn't go to him. It goes to the fact that the CIA would have been holding people, which they claim they weren't holding people.
Yeah, I said
the CIA would never render people away from the situation they were in and hold them under lock and key. On the other side of the break, we're going to be speaking with Ellie Corpus, or Augie is, because I know he has a lot to say about the Reformation of the Catholic Church. You're listening to The Morning Edge.
The new Reformation. Wow. And you told me not to try, but I played it home alive. So you said that only proves that I didn't play. You made but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for. Turn out the light. Save now $5 a pill for Viagra or Cialis in 32-count generic packages. Compare $5 a pill to up to $25 in the U.S. Save On Meds pharmacies have been importing safe, reliable medicine to U.S. customers for 9 years. Get generic Viagra and Cialis for $5 a pill with confidence. Call for a free quote and info. It's Save On Meds. 888-6969-363. 888-6969-363.
Hi, I'm Nick.
I'm Hunter.
And I'm Clayton.
Our Aunt Valerie owns VJ Silver Productions.
Are you having a party and need a DJ?
Call VJ Silver Productions.
Do you need a great photographer or videographer for your wedding?
Call VJ Silver Productions.
VJ Silver Productions can DJ any type of event, weddings, bar mitzvahs, or any kind of party.
Contact VJ Silver Productions at 941-504-0889.
That's 504-0889. Or visit the website at vjsilverproductions.com.
For all of your commercial or residential electrical needs, call Sumter Electric Incorporated, serving Sarasota, Manatee, and Hillsborough County. New construction, remodel, repair. Sumter Electric Incorporated can get the job done. Call 941-723-2810. Breaker panel upgrades, circuit breaker upgrades, surge protection. Just call Sumter Electric Incorporated, serving our community for over 13 years. They're state certified and satisfaction is guaranteed. Service with integrity. Sumter Electric Incorporated is locally owned and operated. Give them a call, 941-723-2810, 941-723-2810, and tell them you heard it on WWPR.
It's The Morning Edge on WWPR 1490 AM. You can listen live online at 1490WWPR.com. You can also get the podcast on demand and go back into the archives, or
If you miss it, you'll be able to usually catch it up, sometime later in that 24 hours, hopefully by the afternoon, at themorningedge.podomatic.com. That's themorningedge.podomatic.com. And also, I want to say it was good to see Rick on the radio back on the air here. Didn't realize it was happening until I saw him live and in person here one afternoon when I was doing some production.
He's 5 to 6, is he?
4 to 6.
4 to 6.
Monday through Friday, 4 to 6. Rick on the radio, burning up the airwaves again. And also, speaking of people we need to tip our hat to, we want to thank Jim Delgado, Scott Cowens, Melton Little for what they do in the community and the
support on the show.
And the scholarship awards, the annual scholarship awards.
What's the story on that?
Wednesday night, they awarded 10 local scholars, just some stellar students, scholarships that no strings attached, just money for whatever they needed in the course of their studies. And just a stellar group of students.
Personal pride. Now you.
Yeah, my daughter, Catherine Raines, was one of them. But this is something they've done for, well, over a decade, I believe, helping these individuals. Commissioner Michael Gallen was the keynote speaker, but a lot of distinguished people to award the students and provide role models for them.
Students from all over Manatee or just in, from?
Manatee County and the Sarasota Military Academy.
Oh.
So they made one exception for the Sarasota people. Scott Callens coaches the lacrosse team there, so he had to, extend the boundary a little bit for his charges. And, again, just interesting to see what these kids.
How long the ceremony was it? What time did you have it?
Oh, well, the reception started 6 to 7, and the banquet was at 7, and then, I don't know, we were wrapped up by about 9, but it was entertaining, a lot of interesting people to listen to there.
I really meant to bring that up on Wednesday so people could go and maybe witness what was going on there, but I apologize for that.
And, of course, we thank Collins a little for their support of this show, and for personal injury, for family law, for criminal defense, Callens Little, and Jim Delgado over there, too. And and then we should also be thanking Pastor Dana for her support of the station and indirectly our show. And that revival goes on through Sunday, 7:30 p.m. I'll be out there this weekend. Probably not tonight, but I'm sure Saturday, maybe Sunday,
yeah,
I'll be out there.
I want to go out and do a little witnessing myself.
Yeah, Hoggy's going to get immersed again and whatever it is goes on out there.
I'm not going to step in the water. I'm going to stay foot dry. But nonetheless, I do want to go up and spend a little time there.
Which is a great segue to our guest,
who
is Ellie Corpus, is religion news analyst and founder of Ellie Spiritual Treasures. She is in demand on the radio talk show and other circuits to give her opinions and information about reforming the Catholic Church, and we want to welcome her here.
Good morning, Ellie.
Ellie Corpus, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm Augie, and you know who Henry is. You list a series of questions. What does reforming the Vatican entail? What decision will the Pope have to make? The decision? And what decision only? Who will he choose as a new Secretary of State? Why is this important? What changes should he make? What should believers expect from the Vatican's reformation? Any one of those in particular you want to tackle or go at all of them?
Oh, we'll just go at all of them. Reforming the Vatican, it entails so many issues. It's been 25 years since the last reform has taken place. In fact, many of the cardinals who are speaking up for this reform, among the biggest issues, I think, is the sexual abuse in the church and the leakage of the papal documents exposing the possibility of corruption within the Vatican.
What type of corruption?
Well, a lot of the documents are confidential documents. So I think that if there's somebody that's exposing these personal confidential documents, that's a real big concern.
Mm-hmm. One of the reforms that I would suggest, and the United States can be the be the one to make that for them. And that is take away or recommend that they have their status as an independent country removed from them, because this is one of the means that they've been able to conceal stuff and hide evidence on the pedophile matters.
Right.
And
I think
that was
that's
done.
Gonna...
That was done under Ronald Reagan, if anybody wants to know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But,
yeah, I think that he's going to really have to step that up as far as trying to get the sexual abuse stuff under control, and I think that that is one of his biggest ventures to take on.
Mm-hmm.
Ellie, we're speaking with Ellie Corpus. She is the founder of Ellie Spiritual Treasures. The website is searching-for-jesus.com. If you want to find out more about that. How did this become a focus of your interest and concern?
Well, as far as my book is concerned, or as far as
In general, we really didn't get a chance to explore your background, so
we probably should do that right now before we get
started. Okay, no problem. Ellie's Spiritual Treasures is a Bible word search puzzle series. And my goal is to encourage people to read the Bible, and I'm doing it one puzzle at a time. Now, the part on the Catholic part, I recently received a license agreement from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops to do the same format for the liturgical years, ADNC, and to allow people to read and do the puzzles before Masses on Sunday or the Holy Days, the Holy Masses. And we're also working on doing the puzzle books in the form of the calendar years for the students, for the schools. So that way they can encourage the kids to also do the puzzles and so forth before their Masses.
And how many Bibles are you going through to do that?
The Bibles that we're going through, the first book that we did was the book of Genesis.
Those are the books within the Bible, but I said how many Bibles are you referring
which,
to? Which
version?
Are the Bibles? Yeah,
translation.
There's about 400 of them.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. There's 11 translations that I'm currently working with, and those are for the general, the book of Genesis, that's what I've been those with. Now, the Catholic ones, the liturgical years, I am sticking with the Catholic Bibles on those.
What have you found as you use 11 different translations and convert these into word search puzzles? Yes. What have you found that you didn't expect to find?
Yeah, what new information?
Well, among the people, I found many, many people that were very leery to read the Bible to begin with because the print was so small and it was such a big book. But by doing it in this type of format, it's really encouraged so many people to read the Bible. And they're doing it in a fun way by doing word search puzzles. And it's also helping so many people with brain injuries and Alzheimer's patients. It's helping many people that have had difficulty with memory problems. And that's a really big goal of mine.
You're treating this as a therapy issue?
It can be. It can be. I had a son that was in a car accident, and he suffered a traumatic brain injury. And his doctor, in fact, is really been one of my big supporters because it's helped so many of her patients with the memory problems and so forth. It stimulates the brain, and so it helps them.
But what does the brain come up with after it's stimulated? The question I have, why would you go to the Old Testament to affirm the New Testament, or is that your point?
Well, actually, the Old Testament, we started out with the book of Genesis because that is the very first of the books. And our next volume is going to be from the New Testament, the Gospel according to Matthew. So we wanted to start out with the very first book. And so we are jumping over to the New Testament on the second book.
Mm-hmm. How beholden are you to the approval of the bishops, especially the Catholic bishops? I mean, if they say to you, well, you're going in a direction we don't like, what do you do?
Well, I actually have gotten the support from our local bishop, and he's very excited.
What bishop in what area?
I'm sorry, I'm in Victoria, the Diocese of Victoria.
That's
Victoria, Texas.
Victoria, yes. Texas. Oh, okay. And,
yes.
And would you,
yes,
describe your bishop as a moderate or conservative bishop?
I would consider him moderate.
Is he open to the discussion of women priests and things of that sort?
We actually have not gotten into that discussion.
The problem I have with this whole issue, the Vatican is, and the papacy is a later creation of the church. It's not from Peter. It came much later.
And much later.
Yeah. What year did it come?
Oh, I can't. 600 years? Has it been 600 years? No.
Well, it would have come about 1200 is in that vicinity. And that was about the time they decided that the priests couldn't marry, because that meant that the monies from the families in the church's gatherings would have gone to the families, and that was cut off, and therefore the hierarchy was begun from the celibate standpoint. That's very over the surface. However, a lot of the problems that I see reforming the Vatican. You have a power structure that's divorced and as a separate nation can conceal all of their sins and not be affected by the country of Italy. If the officials want to come in and investigate what they're doing, they're prevented, because they're dealing with an international piece of territory for 450 people. Now you have Benedict coming back in, parking himself inside the Vatican, which is very odd, which he was not going to do originally, but he is now, to keep an eye on this new pope. And so I just really wonder, what do you think of the history here of the papacy now, especially since John the 23rd died, how conservative, how reactionary it's become, and how protective of the system within that system?
Well, I think it's a big surprise that Pope Benedict is coming back to keep an eye on the new pope.
You are so right. Keep an eye on. That's so true. Why did you say that?
Let us remind people, we're speaking with Ellie Corpus, yeah, religion news analyst and founder of Ellie Spiritual Treasures. You can find out more about Ellie and her work at searching-for-jesus.com. Put a hyphen between each word. searchingforjesus.com. You can also find out more about her books there. I'm sorry, Ellie, go ahead and continue with this.
No. Back to my point. Why is he keeping an eye on? What's that about?
Well, I think that he's being, the new pope, Pope Francis, is being rather humble, and he is taking things just a little bit different than what the Vatican is used to. And I think that may concern many Catholics. And I think that that's maybe one of the reasons why he may be wanting to come around and kind of keep up with stuff.
Uh-huh. Does it cross your mind that John Paul II inherited the papacy on the death of John Paul I, who was a diabetic and many people believe was basically put to death by the nurse who was
I haven't heard that.
There's a book about it. It's called The Smoking Gun, actually. this nun who worked directly under Archbishop, who was Benedict before he became Pope? What was his cardinal's name? Do you know that, Ellie?
No, I don't.
Oh,
I did not know about the.
Well, I'm going to wait a minute, and it's going to come back to me. But anyway, that's fine. That's a different archbishop. Anyway, this nun, and this is all documented. This isn't my opinion, so to speak, but it's been put out there and shut off because it was no autopsy on John Paul I. The point of this is, at the time John Paul I came forward, he announced from the podium that he was going to allow several of the corrupt cardinals, Archbishop Cody and others, to go to jail under the secular oversight of the civil authorities. And that, I feel, sealed his doom. In any event, he died 3 months into his papacy, and John Paul II came in. When John Paul II went to Mexico City, and the families of the disappeared came forward with their problems.
Ratzinger.
Ratzinger. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you, Pat out there.
Called in with the information. Cardinal Ratzinger, who was the secretary of what is, they keep changing the name of the Court of Inquisition, which Ratzinger was head of, but the name keeps shifting and changing to dress it up. But it's Inquisition nonetheless. In any event, Ratzinger's nurse nursed Cardinal Pope John Paul I, who was insulin dependent. And so the long and the short of it, when Pope John Paul II went to Mexico, he told the families of the disappeared, liberation theology is dead and it will go away. The Pope, the new Pope, did the same thing in Argentina, but he claimed to be someone of the poor, by the poor, for the poor, so to speak. Well, if that were true, then he also, on record, has concealed pedophiles in his own personal history. And there was a particular priest that went to Peru, hid out for a while, and then was drugged back through extradition into Argentina and put in jail, and is in jail to this day. The long and the short of that is there is a suspected deal between John Paul Benedict that this Pope in Argentina would be the Pope to follow him by plan. That's why it's such a strange situation in this whole papacy matter. So you have a situation now where the old Pope moves back in to make sure things stay as they are meant to stay. And he's the controlling, he's the string puller, and this is my view. And you are in a position of mixing in the Old Testament into the New Testament, which I think is a...
she's creating puzzle books to help people to learn these. I don't know if there's a mix. She isn't rewriting the Bible.
No, but she is. You are using the Old Testament through this child's approach to puzzle making to justify the New Testament, which
going out here and you haven't even read the puzzle. You haven't figured out your first puzzle yet. You're not even on the website, Augie.
Well, I know. I'm just talking out of Augie's head here. That's all right, Ellie. I'm extemporizing here a little bit. I agree with that. But Henry's very, very touchy. He's now born again on a lot of these matters that we've gone round and round. So he'll be in your corner on this whole matter.
Okay.
So it's perfectly fine with me. I can handle the best and the worst. I can't be on my
own. Well, if Augie's been characterizing what I'm thinking and feeling, we have Wade on the line.
Yes, sir. I'm so pleased to hear what you're discussing this morning. And I hope to, I'm on my way to Sarasota right now, but I hope to get that website and learn more about, is it Sister Ellie?
No. It's Ellie, and I got to get back to
you. The website is searching-for-jesus.com. You'll see samples of her word search puzzles. And all you got to do is click on the link I put in the
rundown. Okay, well, I'll take care of that. But let me tell you that I'm going to be discussing with a bunch of my book group nothing less than Major Barbara, the play by Bertrand Russell Shaw, which takes the Salvation Army and the Armsmakers and puts it to all the turns and twists of religion and militarism and good and evil. And I just wonder if she has an opinion on that or perhaps argue with. I'd like to hear you discuss that.
I'm going to stop crowding
God.
But I laid out a little bit of history here. And I do think, Ellie, you do need to know and realize the relationship as it went from John the 23rd, which is a very liberal pope and a real reformer, to what's transpired since John Paul I died, and that point forward.
Augie, there's a paragraph here. This is from the Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the people are supposed to find in the word search the underlying words, beginning, created, heavens, earth. And you put all this stuff on her shoulders. It's a word search puzzle.
Well, I don't care what, I really do not care whether you go back to Genesis or not, but the New Testament doesn't really go there. It just doesn't. It's a much simpler set of two prayers that Christ left everybody with. But when you fall back onto Genesis as an interesting word game and or excuse to find justification in the Ten Commandments, which are basically punishment commandments, and the part of the 40 commandments, which are all about ultimate death, thou shalt not, or else you're a dead man. That's the kind of nature.
Ellie, we only have a couple minutes left. Yeah. What would you like to take the time now?
I'm sorry, I went over top of you, and I should have let you talk more, and I apologize, and I'll shut up right now.
That's okay. My primary goal with this Word Search Puzzle Book was to encourage people to read the Bible, to learn about what Jesus went through for us. And we did want to start with the book of Genesis because, of course, it was the first book. We do plan on going through the complete Bible. And it's a way to encourage people to read the Bible and learn more. Because there's some people that have not read the Bible. They get to Genesis and that's it. We want them to continue reading. We want them to find their way to be able to read the Bible through this Word Search Puzzle series.
And the website is searching-for, that's the word for, hyphen, Jesus, and when I say hyphen, it's a hyphen symbol, searching-for-jesus.com. You can see samples for yourself of the word search there. Just try them out for yourself. And Ellie, thank you so much for being a good sport this morning, and best of luck with all the puzzle books that you're putting out, and I'm sure you really are getting more people to read the Bible. And
yes, sir.
You have a great day. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ellie.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah, really not.
I'm dragging people back into a medieval mentality. Which is
how is a word search dragging them into the medieval?
Oh, it's so innocent.
It is.
Yeah, it's so seductive and so childlike. Right? Come on, Henry. This is all about.
Who beat you with a word search puzzle book?
You can poo-poo what they're doing here, this whole thing of bringing it down to children. If you heard if you listened to what she said they learn more about the Bible to justify all that Jesus did for you, which is nonsense. Jesus did what he did in his life, and he created a way to affirm God's teaching and not keep it a negative, which is what the Old Testament essentially does through punishment. And if you look back to justifying your existence in terms of being a Christian or not, or a person or humanitarian or not, and then you need punishment as your criteria, you've got a problem. And I think
I'm going to prophesize right now.
All right, you go right ahead.
I'm going to prophesize that somebody is going to go Old Testament on your butt about this interview, and it's not going to be me when you get home.
Oh, really? You think so?
I think so.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Actually, no. I think that's where one of the few areas we really do agree on.
Okay. I think it's just the fact that you just said that you agree is going to make sure that there isn't an agreement.
Oh, no. I'm more than, well, listen, you don't know why the walls shake in the Schmitz household, that's for sure. This is an interesting subject, and I don't think it matters a hill of beans. And my favorite thing to say to people who claim Christianity as their own, embracing it and so forth, it doesn't, if you believe in what Jesus taught, not what the Old Testament said, but what Jesus taught in his two prayers of brotherhood. If you believe in that, whether he was hung on a toothpick or shot to the moon is irrelevant. You've got a crutch there. His teaching was significant. Whether he lived or died beyond it, it doesn't, in my opinion, it matters only that you follow his teaching. If you cannot, if you can only excuse his teaching in terms of his death and resurrection, you got a weak proposition intellectually, and I think if you don't respect the brain you have and use it effectively in thinking it through, that's a problem, and that's a problem of justification. If you need guilt, beat yourself with a strap like the old Muslims do and so forth, have at it, because that's where this stuff comes from. That's where Sharia law comes from. Sharia and the Ten Commandments are the same laws of Moses. So this is where this stuff is at. People who honor the Ten Commandments and criticize and condemn Sharia are talking about the same laws, ultimately. Cut off your hand if it offends you, bury you up to the neck and be stoned for your adultery, etc., etc., etc. On and on. But anyway. So you need guilt? Hey, need the Ten Commandments?
Sounds like that's paragraph C3, subsection B, to the Ten Commandments that didn't make it to the first page.
I think you've got to read the... There's about 40 commandments.
How many tablets did he have to bring down from that mountain to write all that stuff?
You're looking at an illustration of a memory of a whatever.
Oh, okay.
On Monday,
we'll be speaking with Napoleon Gomez. He is the author of Collapse of Dignity. He's going to be speaking about the labor movement in Latin America. Maybe Augie will reform the Catholic Church with him.
You're listening to WWPR. Bradenton, Sarasota, Tampa Bay.
God, this is dumbass.
I was only having fun, wasn't hurting anyone, and we all enjoyed the weekend for a change.